Isn't that a great lyric? You give the healing and grace our hearts always hunger for. If you don't remember anything else, remember that, and this will be a great morning for you. Perhaps you were struck, as I was. Steve Holmland mentioned it also this morning, his observation of the same. The front page of yesterday's paper had the picture of a soldier. A very tough-looking Army Ranger. Grew up in this area. Actually, is exactly the same age as my older son. And Pat Tillman was at the pinnacle of success in areas that so many of in our world want to succeed at. He was an immense physical presence, an all-star NFL football player. He was rich. He was renowned, he had influence, money, fame, status, accomplished it on his own, defied the odds. And on the very day that the National Football League is drafting new players who want to be Pat Tillman, who want the very thing he's succeeded at, and his story, our attention was called to his story because he died in combat. He was in combat because he turned away from all those things he'd succeeded in gaining. He'd gotten to the pinnacle and made the observation that it wasn't good enough, that it wasn't satisfying, that being what all of these folks to whom our attention was drawn on draft day yesterday, being what they wanted to be wasn't what he wanted to be. And he looked for a cause that was greater than himself, wanted to give himself to something that was worthwhile. He fought for freedom. That was his language. Unfortunately, the political freedom and the path he chose wasn't the ultimate one, but it's stirring nonetheless to realize that some make the statement, even in their journey, in their seeking, that having the highest height, having the grand success, having the money, fame, and status is not enough. There is more. I'd like to invite you to turn to the book of Acts, because in this text, throughout the New Testament, particularly this book, this text, we hear stories of other folks who discovered to an even greater extent the same truth, that what this world has to offer is not enough. There's a greater message to believe. There's a remarkable banner to march under. There's something worth giving your life to. That isn't this world's payoff. It's money, fame, and status. And what's endearing about the accounts in the book of Acts is it's not great folks who make these choices. It's not those who the world has already noticed who choose to give their life away in the cause of a greater liberty, a greater freedom. It's ordinary folks, nobodies, unnoticed, without a claim, who've discovered an eternal message and the companionship of Christ, and they set off on a great adventure. And their stories are now captivating to us 2,000 years later. This world doesn't offer what's worth living for, but God does. And in His service, we find what people like Pat Tillman were really searching for, what's worth living for. I'd like to begin reading in verse 9 of chapter 16 of the book of Acts. This is great stuff. A lot of energy here, excitement. I think you'll feel the sea spray in your face as I read. A vision appeared to Paul in the night. A man of Macedonia was standing and appealing to him, saying, "Come over to Macedonia and help us." When he had seen the vision, immediately we sought to go into Macedonia, concluding that God had called us to preach the gospel to them. So putting out to sea from Troas, we ran a straight course to Samothrace, and on the day following to Neapolis, and from there to Philippi, which is a leading city of the district of Macedonia, a Roman colony, and there we were staying in this city for some days. Now this is the preliminary paragraph to the account of what happened in Philippi. And I want to notice some things about the lead-up, this paragraph, this preliminary, before we get to the actual events of that place and and what occurred there. It's stirring, it's challenging, it's wonderful. But what can we learn in the paragraph that leads up to it? I want to say a few things, or observe a few things. First, if you'll go backwards a bit, in earlier in chapter 16, what we have talked about mostly, or observed mostly up to this point, is frustration. Travelers had left Antioch, they'd begun a journey, they veered off course, their original expected course, and had gone hundreds of miles, weeks of time, perhaps months of time, attempting ministry, wanting to go into cities and regions for serving Christ, and were told no. They were told no by God Himself. Not in Bithynia, not in Phrygia, not in the places that are along the way. And there's a tension that's built up in this. Why is God saying no unless He intends to say yes at some point? He must have something better in mind. These are faithful servants. They're not being castigated as failures, not being told they're doing anything wrong. They're just being forbidden. And increasingly we say, okay, Lord, when is the day when You'll say yes? Where is the place You're taking them? And now we have that day. They had come to the city of Troas, a seaport, and Paul has a vision by night, and a word comes from heaven, a vision from God, as they conclude it to be, that He is speaking yes now after having said no for all these miles and days and weeks. So we're excited, along with them, aren't we? Oh, what will happen now? Something important. The anticipated moment. Another thing we can say in this preliminary paragraph that might catch our attention is just the urgency of the language. Luke is now on the team. In a subtle way, we know he includes himself because he starts using first-person plural verb tenses. We did this. We went there. And all of a sudden you realize the author is now in the story. So it gets a little more vivid, partly because he's writing about stuff he experienced, and probably also, most scholars think Luke was himself a Philippian. This is what Philippi was probably his hometown, and he's leaving Troas, he's on the team, they're going to his hometown, he's going to talk about events close to his place, and maybe that fills in some of his excitement as well, or it helps us understand it. What he's excited about, look at it again, is in verse 10, immediately, we sought to go to Macedonia. We sailed a straight course to Samothrace. On the next day to Neapolis. Quickly on to Philippi. No time to waste. Luke likes sea travel, by the way. That's another thing that turns out to be the case. You'll discover more of that as you read the rest of Acts. He likes to talk about sea journeys. I sort of picture Leonardo DiCaprio, on the front of the Titanic, leaning into the sea spray, and he's excited, and we're going, and we can't wait. And the thing that thrills him is we get to preach the gospel. We concluded that God has called us to preach the gospel. What a privilege this is. And everybody I know who retains a sense of privilege about gospel ministry does so because they remain recipients of gospel grace. How do you stay excited about sharing your faith? How do you stay excited about the possibility of new folks coming to know Christ? By feasting on grace yourself. Our hearts always hunger for. And if God is good to us, then it's my delight to see Him be good to someone else. And this is sort of a side point, but if you've lost your enthusiasm for the gospel going into the world, it may be because you need to take a deep drink of grace yourself again. Remember what it means to be loved, and perhaps feel some of the same delight in seeing others loved as well. But anyway, this is all, the language is vivid, he's excited, they can't wait, they're pressing forward, they go immediately, there's hurry and energy in this. Two other things briefly to say about this preliminary paragraph. Paul notes that they stayed some days in the city. This is in verse 12. When they finally get to Philippi, they stay there some days. And the reason that's helpful to know is because we know a lot of the rest of the story. We know that a wonderful church is going to get established here. One of the hero churches of the New Testament is the church in Philippi. It is held out as an example to others. We know that the Philippian letter, the letter to the Philippians, is one of the encouraging documents of the New Testament. It's filled with references to joy and generosity and a call to obedience and hope and friendship and gratitude and all of those things. So they're staying there some days. Having stayed there some days, they will leave behind a great church, a church that receives one of the New Testament letters that has been a blessing to believers ever since. So they, you know, as we read this paragraph with a little bit of knowledge of what's to come, we know that this city is going to have an important part of the great story. The other thing I want to observe as before we read the text that in Philippi, the events in Philippi, is to note that it's a Roman colony, as we're told. And that's important for a number of reasons. Jesus said in his ascension that his followers would one day preach the gospel to the uttermost parts of the earth. Rome was as far as it gets. Rome was the center of the empire that stretched to the ends of the earth as far as anyone in that day knew. It was the center of all power and authority and human gathering of itself together to make life work without God. It was the fountainhead of power, this world's power. The gospel will someday be preached to the ends of the earth, and Paul had even now as an enthusiasm for himself, I want someday to go to Rome. He's leaning that way even so. And this colony, this Philippi, is a federal district. One of the habits of the Romans was, in various places around the empire, they would assign to themselves a circle of territory, and within that territory they would transplant Rome. Most of the lands they conquered remained regions that they controlled that would have their own government, their own names, and so on, and Romans would just exact taxes from them and march armies over them and so on, but the place would remain itself. But in some places, they carved out federal districts, sort of like the District of Columbia in this country, which is not part of Maryland or Virginia, it is just itself. And these places, these colonies became, Roman legionnaires would retire to them, citizens and those who lived in Rome would often move to these places. They reveled in everything Roman. They loved their heritage. They fed on the gossip of the great city and who was politically advancing and who was falling and scandals of the elite and so on. They believed themselves to be Rome, loved everything about Rome. They were an outpost of the city. And these travelers now are going to begin what will be a conquest of the worship of Caesar. They're coming in this place, across the Aegean Sea, to this colony, and they are going to speak of Jesus there. The word of Christ and the power of Rome are on a collision course, and here in this outpost, they collide to begin with. Someday the challenge demanded of Christians who are persecuted by Rome is this: will you say Caesar is Lord or not? They refused time after time and lost their lives because they said Jesus is Lord. The claim that Caesar is Lord is now being advanced against as these intrepid travelers come to this colony. And they're on their way to the heart of things. And today there are uncounted millions of people that say Jesus is Lord, and there are no Caesars left. None. That the message they bore is a message that will change everything. And I think they knew it. Paul, at least from his writings, we would suggest, had some idea of the kind of thing that was beginning to happen. And he, again, leaned forward into it, was excited about it, couldn't wait to see what would happen. So, this paragraph, for a number of reasons, the way it is written, the fact of closed doors in the past and open doors now, and visions from heaven, and the Roman colony that would become the first place of ministry as they crossed the Aegean. We know from history later that Europe would become the place where the church would be planted most thoroughly and survive for two millennia. That important things are on the very doorstep of happening, and we expect something dramatic to take place, don't we? What will happen? Why doesn't he read it? Why does he keep talking? What's going to occur next? Verse 13. And on the Sabbath day, we went outside the gate to a riverside, where we were supposing that there would be a place of prayer. And we sat down and began speaking to the women who had assembled. A woman named Lydia from the city of Thyatira, a seller of purple fabrics and a worshiper of God, was listening. And the Lord opened her heart to respond to the things spoken by Paul. And when she and her household had been baptized, she urged us, saying, "If you have judged me to be faithful to the Lord, and come into my house and stay." And she prevailed upon us. Now let me make a literary observation along the way here. That the story of the gospel in Philippi, the story of the church beginning in Philippi, of the missionaries going to Philippi, is effectively gathers around two different days. It's I don't know why Luke decided to do it this way, but he tells the story of the first day, this day. The first Sabbath, they are there. They go to a riverside to a prayer meeting. Their belief occurs. Some are baptized. And we're going to come back. This is where we're going to spend most of our, give most of our attention today, to this first series of events, the first day. Subsequently, let me read on now, verse 16. There's a second day, a second 24-hour period that tells the tale of all the rest of the events that occur. And it's the last day, just before the missionaries leave town. So effectively, the first day and the last day are at either end of this story. And not, we're not told much else, even though we know a great deal else happened because of the church residing there when they left and so on. But look at verse 16. "It happened that as we were going to a place of prayer, a slave girl having a spirit of divination met us, who was bringing her masters much profit by fortune-telling. Following after her and us, she kept crying out, saying, 'These men are bondservants of the Most High God who are proclaiming to you the way of salvation.' She continued doing this for many days, but Paul was greatly annoyed and turned and said to the Spirit, 'I command you in the name of Jesus Christ to come out of her.' And it came out at that very moment." Now this challenge to a demon begins the last 24-hour period, in which an extraordinary number of things will occur. And it ends with the missionary team leaving town. Now, it's the second day of the text, the last day of their stay, in which all of the excitement that we're expecting occurs. We assume God has something big in mind, and we get to see that God has something big in mind when we come to this final series of events. Demons and dungeons, riots, beatings, magistrates, prisoners, earthquakes and darkness, conversion by candlelight, power encounters, God putting his stamp on things. Jesus will later say earlier said, and when some of his disciples had gone out in ministry and come back to him and reported what was happening, he said, "I saw Satan falling from heaven like lightning." And this last day, these events will take up next week, this dramatic power of God overwhelming the power of the darkness. It has that quality to it too, Satan falling from heaven like lightning. But that's not what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about the first day, the first Sabbath. And I want to suggest to you that it is characterized mostly by being not very cool. The head of steam is built up to hear the story of the open door, the vision from heaven, the immediacy of travel, the longing to preach the gospel. Surely something will happen, and our first take is bland and understated. And why? Is my question for us. We should ask why of the text. Why do we see, first of all, this small circle gathered on a riverside in prayer? Well, I think there's something very important to learn from this. And I hope that we'll be persuaded of it as we think together. Luke is a subtle writer. He's a brilliant historian and chronicler, and he's got some wonderful subtlety about the way he writes, and some of that I think perhaps will help us get a feel for this riverside prayer meeting. It says in the telling of the tale that Paul sat down and began to teach those who gathered at this place. I think Paul's being faithful, but I think he was tremendously disappointed in what he found. The pattern of Paul and Barnabas and those who went on the first missionary journey together, the pattern they had developed, and I think that they believed in it, that they would continue when they went to other places after this one, is to go first to the place where Jews gathered. The pattern is to start where the Bible is already familiar, where the God of heaven's name has been named. And there's a number of reasons, and effectively that's to find the synagogue. The one or another of the synagogues that are in the region, let's go there. And what will you find when you get to the place where Jews gather for synagogue worship? Well, first of all, you'll find Jews. They're reading the Bible, and you can open their eyes to see that Jesus is the Messiah of the Jews. But you will also find Gentiles. Every place throughout the empire where the Jews had a synagogue, they had what is called God-fearers. Lydia is named a God-fearer here. These were Gentiles that were sick at heart of the idolatrous religion they were raised in. And they liked to sit outside the synagogue or in the back of the room and hear God spoken of as loving and powerful and righteous. And their hearts were hoping for Him. So if you want to evangelize a city, the first thing you do is go to the synagogue where the Jews are gathered, and there both conversion of Jews and conversion of Gentiles begins, and the city begins to change. There is no synagogue meeting in Philippi. The reason Paul goes to a prayer meeting by a riverside is, every commentator, I think, will agree, is because there was no synagogue. He looked for one and couldn't find it. And the reason almost certainly there was no synagogue is because the persecution of the Jews had begun in Rome. Claudius had driven Jews out of Rome. He had some uprising had happened. Jews were blamed. He began an active and vicious persecution of Jews. He drove them from Rome. And this little mini Rome in Philippi was doing the same thing. Persecuting Jews, driving them from public view, making them go underground. They were not meeting in public. There were no men mentioned, probably none gathered, who would be willing to sort of stick their head up in times of persecution. So the synagogue is not meeting, and Paul finds himself knowing that some believers would gather for prayer near a water source outside the city. That would be the second choice if no synagogue existed. Looks for the prayer meeting and finds it on a Sabbath day. But as I said, I'm convinced that he was disappointed. Consider what's missing here. Lydia is the only one named, and she's not a Jew. She's a God-fearing Gentile, but she's not a Jew. She doesn't have the history of the Bible that Jews would have. She doesn't know as much as they would know. There's no men mentioned. Paul had seen a vision in which a man appeared to him, said, "Come to Macedonia and help us." Paul, in every place he had been, had seen men come to Christ, and men serve as the backbone of their churches, and that had been true throughout all of the period in Jerusalem and the environs around Jerusalem. It had been true when they'd gone to other places in the empire. You expect to have men on whom the church can depend for leadership. Rome was an aggressively masculine, violent, chauvinistic society. If you've seen the Passion of the Christ and watched the Roman soldiers sort of in vicious gleefulness torment and flog the Lord, you have some idea of the kind of place Rome was, kind of a society it was. Surely, if we're going to see the gospel advance in this place, in this time, in this culture, we are going to need strong men to carry the message. There are no Jews mentioned at the prayer meeting. Probably some, maybe most of the women were. There are no men mentioned at all. If there was one there, he was being quiet. And Paul, in my imagination, is looking up from this circle. He's faithful. These are the ones God's given. He sits down. He teaches them. He will deliver the message that he's been given to deliver. But he's looking up back toward the city and wanting to know, how will God do a work here? How can we start with this small group made up of these kind of people and see anything good come of it. I mentioned the subtlety of the language. It says that as Paul was speaking, Lydia opened her heart to the Lord. It doesn't say that he got to finish. And the suggestion is that he didn't. This is a woman who was so ready from her prayers, from her hopes, from her suffering, from her needs, so ready to receive Christ that Paul was halfway, partway, a third of the way, who knows, through his message, and her, the Lord opens her heart and she comes to faith. Which, when I say it, is a little disconcerting for preachers. You like to sort of get to the crescendo. You know, you like to be able to make the point and wave your arms and tell the joke and, you know, and then have somebody respond and you sort of get credit for having done it well. You know, have been so darn persuasive that what else could they do? But he doesn't even, that doesn't even happen. She responds before he finishes his message. The other point of that's, again, I think a bit subtle in this, is it says that at the end of the day, she has to persuade him to come to her house. And that word in Greek implies resistance. Badgered him, perhaps, to come to her house. I wouldn't take no for an answer, is the idea. That this woman is overtaken by the grace of God. And she opens her heart to the Lord and she opens her home to be used. You see in verse 40, by the end of the story of the ministry in Philippi, they are still meeting in Lydia's house. It becomes the center for evangelism and worship and ministry and Christian growth. Probably the letter, the Philippian letter later delivered to the city was delivered to her house as the church perhaps continued to meet there. It becomes the center place. But Paul didn't want to go there at first. No, Lydia, you know, thanks for the offer, but you know, we've got to find a way to evangelize the city. We've got to find the key to get into this place. We've got to find the open door that God will give to us. No, sorry, thanks a lot. It's a great offer, but what? You know, you're single. How would it look? We come to your house. You know, it's a great offer, and it's really good of you. But we are going to seek out God's plan for. I understand. It's a nice, you know. And about the fourth or fifth time, they finally realize they don't have any other options, and they agree. She persuaded them against some resistance to come to her house. Now, again, the question to ask is why, given the vision, the enthusiasm, the high expectation, why did the missionaries first get to that city and encounter what must have been very disappointing to them? Lord, let us engage in battle. Lord, let us persuade the important. Lord, bring us some who will believe and some who will deny, and let us speak of you in the high places to the important people. Give us men, Lord, who will support the cause and give us strength in the battle. And here is one woman in her household who believe, and that becomes kind of the strategic entree to this city, which is a mini Rome, which will someday lead to the conversion of an empire. Jesus is Lord, not Caesar. And that message is effectively beginning its journey in this time and place. Why this way? Well, let me say a couple things that occur to me that I think are important and helpful and perhaps challenging to us. Lydia is a misfit. And the point being made here is the reason that the gospel is powerful is because misfits bear it well. It is not required that bright and important and connected people serve Christ for the truth to be made plain, for His power to be displayed. In fact, it's the reverse. He chooses other kinds. And the reason this message has prevailed for 2,000 years will prevail to the end, the reason that we can be certain He keeps His promises is because of the kind of people that He chooses, meaning folks like us. Lydia is a misfit. Consider the ways. She is not a Philippian. She wasn't from the town. Her family wasn't there. She didn't have neighbors that she'd grown up with and folks she'd known for years. And she was from Thyatira, we're told. She's a merchant who worked in that city, but this is not her home city. She is not a Jew. She's a God-fearer, but she's not one with steeped in the Old Testament that could have drawn on that to sort of begin ministry using her vast knowledge of her training as a Jew. She's not a Roman. Some that immigrated to Philippi from Rome. Some had come from the greater city with greater connections in the, but she's not from Rome either. She's from Thyatira, which is a very ordinary city. She's not a man. She's not married. It says that her household believed and was baptized along with her. If she were married, it would have been her husband's household. She had her own household, which almost certainly means that she wasn't married. She's successful in business by her own efforts, which has been tough for women in most ages of history, was extraordinarily tough in the time of the Roman Empire. And yet she had gone to a new place, she had brought her goods, she had sold them and succeeded, had a household of her own. She spoke with an accent. She's not from here. She's a misfit. And yet God opened her heart. She's a misfit, but look at the example she bears the example she gives us. She was hungry for the presence of God. She went to the prayer meeting, even though many, because of the persecution of Jews, had ducked their heads and not gone. She'd gone to the prayer meeting because she loved to pray, we assume, because she longed for God. She didn't know anyone would show up that day, but she went always to prayer meetings because she wanted to pray, because God meant something to her, even though it was cloudy and uncertain yet. It says that her heart was open. She melted at the hearing of the gospel of the love of Christ. And she not only opened her heart, but she opened her home. She responded with generosity. Having been given a great gift, she wanted to give something in return. She listened to the voice of the Lord in salvation, and she listened to the voice of the Lord in saying that it was His desire to use her. You know, at first, she was told no, but she didn't take no for an answer because she was listening to a more important voice that was saying yes. The last thing I'd say about her, I think, is that she's stubborn. She's stubborn because she knew the truth. She's stubborn because she'd heard from her master that she was the one who should serve him. And her stubbornness, I think, is commendable as well. I don't read this as defensive or whiny or awash in grievances against life's unfairness, but she was confident that God wanted to use her. And eventually she persuaded everybody else to believe the same thing. Misfits matter to God. They are the ones He chooses. This room is filled with women who have been overlooked, gifted single folk who question themselves but ought not, emigres whose accent has diminished their message, some with great wisdom who weren't educated at the best schools, some with great courage and ability who are too young to have a resume to prove it. People that get overlooked. People who are raising their hand to serve, but sometimes the vision of those making the decisions is some other place. And yet God chooses misfits, the unexpected. And I hope that Paul, he was doing the best he could. He didn't expect things to go this way. He was looking for answers. He heard God's voice. He was persuaded eventually. And God's people are like that. Godly leadership is like that. But the insistence of the text, I think, the great voice of the text, is that if we're going to start taking down Caesar worship, if we're going to break the back of idolatry, if Rome will end someday and end with the cause of Christ continuing on in its lands, if all of that will happen, it will happen because misfits the unexpected are chosen by God to begin the process. Look around you. Look at people near you. I want to take 2 seconds, 5 seconds to look around you. Draw some conclusions about the folks that you see in the room around you. He puts his treasure in earthen vessels, not in vessels of gold and silver. Earthen vessels. For consider your calling, brethren. There are not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble. God has chosen the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God has chosen the weak things of the world to shame the things which are strong. And the base things of the world and the despised God has chosen, the things that are not, so that he might nullify the things that are, that no man may boast before God. But by his doing, you are in Christ Jesus, who became to us wisdom from God and righteousness and sanctification and redemption. So that just as it is written, let the one who boasts, boast in the Lord. Please stand and we'll sing together a song, which is a prayer. Take my life and let it be consecrated to thee. We sang it earlier. We're going to sing it again as our closing prayer.